The sun has gone down at Hangman's Hill, and the ghost at Misery Corner isn't walking tonight. So, welcome to the Weird Tales Radio Show, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, magic, and folklore. And now, here's your host, writer, award-winning journalist, best-selling author, and sometime werewolf hunter, Charles Christian.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Weird Tales Radio Show. We have another fantastic interview this week, so let's get on with it straight away. Our guest is American author, editor, journalist and actor Mark Dawidziak, who is here to talk about vampires in books and on the screen, including that much-loved TV cult favourite Kolchak, The Night Stalker. We'll also be discussing Rod Serling and The Twilight Zone, as well as the 40-plus years Mark has been playing Mark Twain on the stage. Mark is the author or editor of over 25 books, including 5 on Mark Twain. He is a journalism graduate of George Washington University and has worked as a theatre, film and TV critic since the late 1970s. He's also been the television critic for The Plain Dealer in Cleveland, Ohio since 1999 and a member of the Television Critics Association's Board of Directors for 5 years. He has won 5 Cleveland Press Club Awards for entertainment writing, as well as a Society of Professional Journalists Award for coverage of minority issues. He's currently teaching part-time as an adjunct professor at Kent State University, in addition to writing for The Plain Dealer. Good to be talking to you. If we can just wind back time, because you've got an interesting career in journalism, but you've also been playing Mark Twain for, 40-plus years in various theatre shows. I can see the attraction because looking at your photo, there's a similarity there.
Let's say I've grown into it. or aged into it would probably be the better description. I was 22 when I first started playing Mark Twain.
Yeah. What came first, the journalism or the Mark Twain, or was it a combination of the two?
Well, the interest in Twain came first, but the playing Twain almost about the same time, because I started my journalism career at the age of 21, right out of college, and I started playing Mark Twain at 22. So they're almost parallel tracks.
Yeah.
And because of the of COVID, I haven't had as much chance to crawl into the white suit.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because I'm guessing all the live shows ended sometime early last year. What's the prospect for getting back on stage?
Well, right now it was looking good. We'll see what happens with the variant surges we're getting. You know, in our area, the numbers are good, so hopefully we'll get some performances in next year.
Yeah.
We offer an awful lot of our theater company. My wife and I have this kind of mom and pop theater company, and we offer a lot of different types of shows. But one of the types of shows we do at our busiest time of year is really October. That is our spooky shows. We do a show about pieces from Edgar Allan Poe. We do a show about the Twilight Zone. We do a show about the classic Universal monsters. We do a show about Ghosts of the Civil War. October has become our busy month. December used to be when we used to do a lot of shows based on the works of Charles Dickens.
Right.
Sad to say that the Dickens work has disappeared and the spooky work has gone up. So we're doing October has become our busy month by far. But the other constant is Mark Twain, and that we do over the last year, we were able to do an awful lot of virtual performances. And that's fine. That's really works quite well with the spooky shows or talks or things like that. But it does not work very well for Mark Twain, because you need an audience response. You need to hear what the audience is hearing and how they're responding, engaging how they're responding. So I haven't played Twain. As a matter of fact, the last chance I got to play Twain was a descendant of Charles Dickens, Gerald Dickens, who is a fine actor and portrays his great-great-grandfather on stage, Gerald was doing a recorded show as a benefit for the Dickens House in London.
Yeah.
And he asked me if I would sort of come in as a guest and do Mark Twain's voice, because Twain had seen Dickens perform in New York at Steinway Hall and left a couple accounts of it. So he asked me if I would do that. So it's kind of interesting that somebody named Dickens gave me a chance to play Twain recently.
Yeah, we tend to forget that Mark Twain's life overlapped with Dickens' life. We tend to think of Dickens as being very much high Victorian.
They were ships passing in the night, for sure. In fact, they were ships passing in the night. They were literary ships passing in the night. Twain's on his way up as Dickens is on his way out. And I think one of the things that people are always stunned to find out, for two reasons. One is that for the sheer amount of work Dickens did in his lifetime. And the second is because if you look at pictures at the end, you think you're looking at a man who's in his 70s. Well, Dickens died at 58. Mm. He burned out. He literally was like a steam engine, went through life as a steam engine. So Dickens dies in 1870 at 58, you know, and that's just when Twain is coming into his own. And they were kind of mirror figures. They were both the major family author of the 1800s in their respective country, and they were popular in each other's country. Mm. They both had boy narrators. They both popularized the use of vernacular in writing. They both started out as humorists. They both started out with pen names as humorists.
Yeah.
Dickens shed his as Boz, and Twain kept his as a persona, as Sam Clemens as Mark Twain.
Yeah.
But they were in this, interestingly enough, they were in the same place at the same time. They didn't meet. But Twain did go to see Dickens read on his reading tour of America, and saw him at Steinway Hall in New York. And he left these two amazing accounts of Dickens as a reader. And it's interesting because Twain is going to go on the play. Twain is going to replace Dickens as the most popular platform performer of his day. He's going to take over, basically. And had Dickens lived just two more years, they would have met. They would have met. And when Twain goes to London in 1872, he meets everybody. And in fact, he meets Charles Dickens Jr. And Charles Dickens Jr. stays at Twain's house in Hartford. So they are they undoubtedly would have met. And here you have these two great writers who were also great performers. And that is really intriguing to me because, as Kurt Vonnegut once said, that it's almost psychologically impossible for a great writer also to be a great performer. The psychological gears you need for those two are almost so big they're in conflict with each other. And the exceptions were so rare that Vonnegut could only think of Homer, if there was a Homer, Moliere, who was a playwright and an actor, Twain and Dickens. And you know, he couldn't think of any other exceptions, really, to that rule.
Yeah, it does seem that way. I mean, anybody filling that slot nowadays?
I don't know. Writers, I mean, again, it's such a specific year. I'm talking about great. I'm not just talking about being a good performer. You know, the leading actor of the time, the 1800s, the late 1800s in England was Sir Henry Irving. You know, he's the first actor to be Sir anything. So he is the icon. You know, I always try to explain to people, you know, just how big Sir Henry Irving is because he's largely forgotten today. And, you know, the first thing I start with is he's the first one to go down on a knee in front of a monarch and, you know, arise Sir Henry Irving. He's so big. When he died, he was buried in Westminster Abbey, you know, so I mean, he made the big room when he died. So, you know, it just doesn't get any bigger than Sir Henry Irving. And Irving once said to Twain, my dear sir, it's a shame, you know, you could write. Because the stage lost a great performer when, you know, and somebody, a leading actress of her day once said it's almost the exact same thing to Dickens.
Yeah.
You know, they were both hams, and writers tend to be anonymous. They tend to like being anonymous. They tend to like life behind the keyboard or the quill pen, if you will. And both these writers like the spotlight. They like being recognized. The Twilight Zone is, obviously the subject of one of my books, and Rod Serling was a ham. Rod Serling was a celebrity. He was one of the great exceptions among writers, a true 14-carat celebrity, the way Dickens and Twain were. The difference is that I would not say that Rod was a great actor. He was wonderful as the narrator on The Twilight Zone. He was wonderful as a presence, but I wouldn't say he was a great actor. He never had that kind of a performance or that performance profile that Twain and Dickens had. So the exceptions are very, very rare. And the answer is no, I can't think of anybody who sort of fits that kind of profile. But you would say, truly, these two guys could have made their livings as performers.
Yeah.
You know, just as easily as they could have as writers.
Yeah.
And that is that's an amazing thing to say.
Yeah. Now, I've got a note here saying you regard Mark Twain and Rod Serling as, I quote, moralists in disguise.
That's right.
Discuss.
Well, I do a whole talk on that. We could be here. This could chew up the rest of your time if I just pursue this. But that phrase actually comes from a letter that a French girl named Helene Picard sent Mark Twain in the last decade of his life. He got this amazing letter. And you have to understand that for the majority of Mark Twain's life, and also for the majority of the next 50 years after he died, say for like he died in 1910, and then up until about 1960, Twain is largely viewed as this avuncular, grandfatherly man of letters. He's kind of, Will Rogers in a white suit or the heir to Ben Franklin.
Yes.
He's a family author. He's a humorist. What we do not see, the Mark Twain that we know today really becomes more enlarged and more in focus in the 1960s, when we understand that Twain is this great social critic, and all of the writings that his daughter suppressed for fear that they would hurt his reputation actually enhanced his reputation, because Twain got bigger and bigger in the 60s as we began to see what an amazing writer he was, and that there were so many more dimensions to him than just that. So one of the things that this little girl wrote in this letter was, she said, I understand that the world knows you as primarily a funny man, but I suspect that behind all of the laughter, there is a very serious person who is trying to teach us something. It's an amazingly perceptive letter.
Yes.
And Twain wrote back to her. And what he wrote back was a letter which basically said, shh. You've got it.
Yes.
You're exactly on it, but don't tell anybody. Don't tell anybody, because I am a moralist in disguise. Now, I love that phrase, because I can't think of a better phrase for Rod Serling, who basically used The Twilight Zone to get across the messages that he increasingly could not get across as television grew up. You know, when Rod Serling started his career in television, it was the Wild West. There were no rules. They were making it up as they went along.
Yeah.
And at the end of the 50s, it was nothing but rules. It had turned into, you can't say this, and you can't do this, and you're not allowed to do this, and these stations will get upset, and the sponsor will get upset. And Rod was so so completely frustrated by this that his answer was to go into the Twilight Zone. His answer was to retreat into the Twilight Zone, where he could say the exact same things, but just couch it in fantasy. Yes. And the gamble of the Twilight Zone was that he could speak about war. He could speak about prejudice and bigotry. He could speak about ignorance and how we treat children and older people. That he could, all the themes that he'd been writing about, basically, and he cared about, that he would write all about these things. And if he couched it in fantasy, nobody would raise an eyebrow or an objection. And he was exactly right. He became, you know, our moralist in disguise. And the way Twain used humor to sort of hide the message, Serling used fantasy. So they are parallel figures in a lot of ways. You know, just as Dickens and Twain have all of these personal and professional parallels that run through their lives, and there's a lot of them with Dickens and Twain. A lot of the same forces, just in different countries, shape them. There are a lot of parallels between Rod Serling and Mark Twain, but the primary one and the most important one is the fact that they were both moralists in disguise, and they both believed in using writing to get the message across. And how do you get the message across? Well, in Twain's case, it was to get people laughing. And if you got them laughing, you got a very, very good chance to tell them the truth.
Yep.
And, you know, one of Twain's disciples was George Bernard Shaw. And Shaw, he's kind of a very Twain-like figure. We've got this almost like handing of the baton back and forth across the Atlantic that takes place, where, you know, Dickens hands it to Twain and then Twain hands it to Shaw. But, you know, Shaw said at one point, they met, you know, Twain went to England, was in England a few times in the last years of his life, most, you know, conspicuously to get an Oxford degree. And he and Shaw met. And Shaw thanked him. Shaw basically said, you know, you taught me how to do this. You taught me how to do this. And Shaw once said that what he learned from Mark Twain was the basic lesson that if you were going to tell people the truth about themselves, you'd better make them laugh or they'll kill you. So, you know, Shaw kind of picks this up. And you know, you have this. That's an amazing thing that humor does. You know, humor allows us to, like, humor and horror are twins. They are the two forms, oddly enough, they are the two forms which don't get a lot of respect among a lot of serious literary critics.
Yes, I know. It's not proper.
And you know, and but among writers, it is accepted.
Yeah.
And when I say writers, I mean real writers, people who put it on the line and make a living as professional writers, you know, because, you know, and I have nothing against academics. You know, some of my best friends are academics, and I teach at Kent State University.
I was going to say, you're a part-time academic.
Yeah, well, I pretend. You know, I've got my lowly bachelor's degree. They let me, you know, show up and pretend to be a professor. But you know, a lot of that is theory. A lot of that is I teach a writing course at Kent State, and I have since 2009. And one of the things I tell my students is, you know, I've had English students take the course, and they always tell me at the end of the course they learn more about writing from my course than they did from courses they took in the English department. And I said, you have to understand that I am operating under a handicap, you know, which is I can't teach theory in this class. You know, this is my theory. If I don't write well enough, my family doesn't eat. How's that for theory?
Yes.
If I don't write well enough, they shut the heat off in the house. If I don't put nouns and verbs together effectively enough, they, you know, we are thrown out in the cold. That's my theory. How do you like that? You know, so when I say that, you know, among professional writers, it is a given that the two hardest forms to write, to master, are humor and horror. It's why we've had so few true masters of both forms.
Yeah.
The mystery writer, John D. MacDonald, I quote this a lot, but it's one of my favorite lines. John D. MacDonald, the great mystery writer who was a writer's writer, wrote in the introduction to Stephen King's first collection of short stories, Night Shift, that the two hardest forms of writing to master were humor and horror. And that was because in the wrong hands, the humor became horrible and the horror became humorous.
Yeah, I like that.
And they're deceptively difficult forms to write. And it is why we've had so few true acknowledged masters of the forms. And so it's and the reason these two forms endure and they are so important is because metaphorically they give us the means to address the issues and the things that we don't like to think about, the things that are tough to get our minds wrapped around. Humor does it. And so think about how much humor is based in pain and about scary things in your life. Well, the same thing is true of horror. And these two let us wrap our minds around those big questions, those big things. And they don't get a lot of respect, you know. You know, it was once said that if you write humor, you're relegated to eating at the children's table, yeah. You know, which was a way of saying, you know, you're not taken seriously. It's sort of considered a genre which is in the sub-basement.
Yeah.
It's not really important. But in fact, they are two of the most important genres which exist.
Moving on to, if you like, more into horror, one of the people you have written about and talked about a lot is Richard Matheson. Among his many works is I Am a Legend, which currently is all over social media because people are now using the plague in I Am a Legend as an excuse for not having the COVID vaccination.
Yeah, which is nonsense.
Yes. I mean,
obviously people who have not read the book.
Haven't spotted that it's under fiction, yes.
Not only under fiction, but that's not the premise of the book. You know, the premise isn't that there was a vaccination and it caused these things. That's not the premise. You know, it's like, well, everybody is like, well, go read the book, come back and we'll have a discussion. You know, the whole idea was that there was a mutation. It's not a lot different from what Stephen King did in The Stand, that there was a mutation.
Yeah.
You know, that's what's causing the I don't remember a vaccination causing people to turn into zombies in I Am Legend. You know, that part eluded me, you know, that all the world got these vaccinations and that's what happened. Richard didn't write that, you know, and it's certainly selling that book short because that book is not about any such thing. It's not about the dangers of a pandemic. It is not about the dangers of, science gone crazy. It is a study in isolationism, of being isolated, of the feeling of being isolated. It's a theme which runs through a lot of Richard's work, especially his early work. Richard was dealing with those themes of feeling like an outsider and isolated. And so many of his stories are about people coping with that, especially his early stories. Neville in I Am Legend is the ultimate outsider. He is the last human in a world overrun with vampires. It's the Shrinking Man, turned into the movie The Incredible Shrinking Man. It's about somebody who is literally withdrawing from the human race as he gets smaller and smaller. Duel, which Steven Spielberg turned into the classic TV movie, is about a lone man up against an almost faceless mechanized threat.
Yes,
The Night Stalker, which he wrote the screenplay for, is about an ultimate outsider, Carl Kolchak, who is trying to tell people, and nobody will believe him, that there's a threat, there's a vampire, it's the truth. Listen to me. A lot of his Twilight Zone episodes that Richard wrote were about the lone person up against the Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, where there's only one person who can see the gremlin on the wing and nobody believes him.
Yeah.
The Invaders with Agnes Moorehead as the woman in the farmhouse, and her farmhouse is invaded by beings from another planet, and she's alone. She's all alone. In this, there it is. That theme comes up again and again and again in Richard's work. That's what he's truly writing about in I Am Legend. It's a very scary book. It's a very, powerful book. It is the most important vampire novel after Dracula. Mm-hmm. But, the thing about horror is it's a very malleable form. And it's always open to interpretation.
Yeah.
What was Robert Louis Stevenson writing about when he wrote Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde? You know?
Yeah.
Was he writing about the dangers of alcoholism? Because, you know, this is a drink, and with a drink brings out a monster, and a monster that he can't control, and he can't control the urge to go back to the drink. Is it about drugs? Is it about the battle of good and evil in every individual? Is it about man's response to God? I didn't create me. You created me. Why am I to blame for the way I am? What is Jekyll and Hyde about exactly? Well, you know, thank goodness Robert Louis Stevenson never told us why he wrote Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and no more than Bram Stoker told us why he wrote Dracula. So these books have been open to interpretation and probably misinterpretation ever since they hit print. And we've been, you know, discussing and arguing about what they are, what they mean, what's it really about. And, well, the only person who really gets a vote is you.
Mm.
You know, so if you read I Am Legend and you see it as some kind of anti-vaccination, I would say you've probably missed it. But if that's your interpretation, all I ask is that you read it first.
Yes.
Then come back and tell me this is your interpretation and defend it. You know, it's just like Richard became a very good friend, and I ended up editing 3 volumes of his work for him. And we had, you know, just a wonder. He ended up mentioning me in the dedications of 2 of his books. And, you know, that'll bring you up short real fast. You know, you could think you're pretty hot stuff, but when all of a sudden you end up in the dedication of a book by Richard Matheson, you could, you know, think, well, I can retire now. That's that's pretty good. But, you know, another writer who was good friends with Richard and I became good friends with too is Harlan Ellison.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Harlan once famously said, you know, the phrase he always hated was everybody is entitled to their own opinion. And he said, you're not entitled to a stupid opinion. You know, you're taking up air on this planet. You're taking up vital resources. The one thing you are obligated to do is to use the brain that nature has issued you. So no, you're not just entitled to your opinion. You're entitled to your informed opinion, because without information, true information, and facts and research, then you know, opinions are nothing but wind after after that. So you're not entitled just to say, well, that's my opinion and I'm entitled to it. You know, you're entitled to be informed and form an opinion. That's what an opinion is. So, you know, but if you truly come to that interpretation of I Am Legend or Dracula or anything else, I may disagree with you, but I will also fight for your right to interpret it that way.
Yeah.
You know, Dracula certainly has been interpreted countless ways. And the thing about horror as a metaphoric form, it is so powerful and so malleable that you can bend theories around almost any work and make it work. That's what horror kind of does. It's a very individual response. You know, I mean, Dracula is not quite really about, you know, what Bram Stoker was writing about. It's really about your response to it. Dracula is a book which, you know, is about a character who casts no reflection in the mirror. You know, and the challenge of Dracula is that it asks you to peer into the mirror and see what's looking back at you. And the response to the horror is always about what fears you brought to the book. What dreams, what hopes, what aspirations, what nightmares, all of these things you bring to horror. And it's why our response to humor and horror is, they are the most individual responses, those two genres elicit. I'll give you a very simplistic, and I use this with my students at Kent State, but I'll give you an example of that. I said, you know, we could all be outside right now in front of this building and seeing somebody just steaming along in full stride, and all of a sudden they trip and they fall spectacularly. I guarantee half of you are going to burst out laughing. And the other half are going to run to see if the person's okay. Those are two very legitimate human responses. We all know people who think there's nothing funnier than somebody falling down.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, a lot of silent comedy was built on that premise of somebody falling down.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it is a time, there's a very human response to that. As in, then the people who laughed might run to see if the person's okay, but their first instinct was to laugh.
Yeah.
I said, right there, you sort of have the response to it. And it's why if you ask somebody, if you had 10 people and you ask them, what's the funniest movie you ever saw? Or what's the scariest movie you ever saw? There's a very good chance you're going to get 10 different answers.
Hmm.
Is that, you know, somebody can admire a movie and, you know, another thing I do with my students at Kent State is, I don't teach this class anymore. I wish I did, but I used to teach a class on vampires in film and television where we would go all the way from Nosferatu up to the current stuff.
Yeah.
And each week we would look at something and we would discuss how vampires always reflect what's going on in the culture at a certain time, a certain history. Now, I mean, if you want to go, instead of I Am Legend, go to a different vampire story. Go to Nosferatu, because that movie was completely shaped by a pandemic.
Hmm.
You know, that movie comes out in 1922 after World War I and the Spanish influenza.
Yeah.
And it comes out in Germany, a defeated nation. And it's about a plague bearer. It's about, you know, they use sort of the historic fears of the great plagues to metaphorically comment on what we had just gone through with the Spanish influenza. And, you know, to make the matter sure, F.W. Murnau made that vampire look like a rat. He looks like a rodent.
Hmm.
The very symbol of the carrier of the plagues. It was actually the fleas that were carrying the plagues, but the rats got the blame because the rats were the carriers.
Yeah.
So they became the face of the great plagues. And so Murnau sets the story not in Transylvania and London, as Stoker does. He sets the story in Bremen, a port town in Germany, and he sets it in the 1830s during what was one of the last great pandemics. And there are rats running all through that movie. You not only have a vampire looks like it, like no vampire looks like that again. That's not the way Stoker describes him in the book.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the way he's going to appear on a stage. That's not the way he's going to appear in the 30s and 40s when he's going to look like Bela Lugosi and Christopher Lee. He looks like the only time he's going to look like this again is when people mimic the Nosferatu look later on, as they do in Salem's Lot or the remake of Nosferatu.
Yeah.
And that's because, you know, there's no need to. So that movie is completely shaped by pandemic. That is a completely shaped by what the world had just gone through. And it has to. You know, you can't write a sonnet in your times and not be influenced by your times.
Yeah.
And every writer is. So every vampire always kind of reflects what was going on in a certain time period and what was going on in the culture, what was going on in history. And if you just look, you'll see it. If you just look carefully enough, you'll see it. You know. So, you know, Dracula as a book is one of the most interpreted horror stories and reinterpreted horror stories. You know, in its day, some people thought it, you know, Dracula was about syphilis.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, Dracula is a disease of the blood. And of course, this was a period where British society was terrified of syphilis and what it was doing to the great families of England. And, you know, there's this contamination of the bloodline. It was a big issue.
Yeah.
Does that work as a metaphoric interpretation? Sure, it works. Yes, it does. Do I think that's what Stoker was writing about? I doubt it. But guess what? It works.
Yeah.
Some people saw Dracula as a study in xenophobia, the fear of foreigners.
Mm-hmm.
And Dracula is a foreigner. And does that work? Yeah, that works too. There was even a theory at the time that it was a Marxist tract, that Dracula was a symbol of the cultured elite classes, and he was sucking the masses dry. Yeah, that he was, you know, he was preying on the masses. And he says, well, that works too, actually. All of these interpreters. In the 90s, Dracula was embraced as an AIDS metaphor. You know, Stoker knew nothing of AIDS. Yep. Hadn't been discovered yet, you know. But does it work as an AIDS metaphor? Yeah, sure it does. So that's the great thing about horror and, you know, the greater tent of fantasy storytelling is it tends to be wonderfully metaphoric. And it also, the response always comes from what's inside you. You're going to have a very individual response. So I always ask my students at Kent State the first night the same question, which is I always say, look deep within yourself, take a couple minutes and answer this question. What scares you? What are you afraid of? Then I always say, don't lie, because I'll know if you're lying. They never questioned that. How would I know if they were lying? You know, but they do give honest answers, and they're all over the map. You get some classic fears, like heights, and the dark, and claustrophobia, spiders and snakes. But you also get some very profound ones, like the notion of eternity, or the fear of being alone. And you also get just ones which are. I once had a young student, a female student, who just shuddered and said the word octopus. And it's her fear. She can't be wrong. Yeah. If that's what you're afraid of, that's what you're afraid of. They are the two responses. Not only are they twins, but you can't fake them.
Yeah.
You can't lie to yourself about what makes you laugh and what scares you. You can lie to yourself about a lot of things, and we do. It's a defense mechanism for how we kind of get through the day. But you can't lie. Something either scares you or it doesn't. You scream with terror or you scream with laughter, and it's a very, very basic elemental response. And again, you give – and everybody's had the experience where somebody tells a joke and everybody laughs and you're the only one not laughing.
Yeah.
And you're sitting there thinking, I don't get it. Yeah. Why is that funny? Or the reverse, where you tell a joke and you say, this is the funniest joke I've ever heard. And nobody laughs when you tell the joke. we've all had that kind of experience. Well, that's humor and horror in a nutshell right there. You know, it's a very, very almost private thing. So, you know, if you read I Am Legend, if you read Dracula, if you read any of the great horror books, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, I suppose I should be saying Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, by the way, which is the proper pronunciation of the doctor's name. Your response to it, you know, is going to be what you bring to it, not what's on the printed page so much as how you respond to what's on the printed page.
As going back to Richard Matheson, the Kolchak Night Stalker series. Now, this is one of those that it was shown hit and miss over here in the UK, but tended to be shoved around very late at night and changing schedules. So you were lucky if you ever saw consecutive episodes. So it rather disappeared and never quite had the impact. Now, why has it developed an almost legendary take in later years?
Well, I think the answer to that is, and I don't know, I'm going to be careful here because I don't know how legendary it is. I mean, that's an odd thing for me to say, given how much time I have spent in the company of Karl Kolchak and how many books that I've written that are Kolchak-centric in some way or another. But I don't know how much impact he still has. I know there's a devoted group of followers on Facebook, on various Facebook pages. And I know that there is, you know, an international following, that he has fans in Australia and New Zealand and England and such. But and the size of the actual fandom eludes me. I don't know exactly how much there is, and I doubt that it's as vast as I kind of sometimes hope it is. And the reason I say that is because I show the film to my students at Kent State and have since 2009. So twice a year, I would introduce this to a group of students at Kent State, and not one of them recognized the name Night Stalker or Carl Kolchak. And I would always set up the film by telling them, you are about to see the best known unknown horror story of all time.
Yeah.
And when it's over, they love it. The great thing is that the magic that worked then works now, and it works with 18, 19 year olds who have grown up in a world of CGI and, you know, the best special effects possible. And there's this crummy movie from 1972, which was made with no budget, no special effects, bad stunt doubles. And they love it. We come out of it and they look at you like, well, how did I not know about this? How did I not know? I think that one thing that has kept Kolchak holding on is just because he has had such a tremendous influence going forward. You know, it all shows up in the 90s, which is about right. Kolchak airs, the original movie airs January 1972. And then about 20 years later, the people who were watching Kolchak have grown up and they start making horror TV and movies on their own. And the influence shows up everywhere. You know, it most notably shows up in The X-Files, because Chris Carter tells anybody who will listen to him that he created The X-Files because the Night Stalker scared him when he was a kid. Mm-hmm. But it shows up in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. It shows up in Men in Black. Going into the new century, it's going to show up in Supernatural. It's going to show up in all forms of storytelling, fantasy and horror storytelling. And the wonderful thing about horror fans, one of the many wonderful things about horror fans, is that they are one of the very, very few groups of fans that tend to be aware of the history and their origins and are willing to try out and look back. I mean, there's a lot of people who will say, you know, I love musicals. And when they say that they love musicals, they actually mean they love anything from Les Mis on.
Yeah.
And they're unaware of anything that's come before it.
Yes.
And you say, like, you know, Rodgers and Hammerstein, Cole Porter, Irving Berlin,
you
know? Yeah. Guys and Dolls, My Fair Lady, you know, it's almost like people who like comedy, but they no longer know who the Marx Brothers are. They no longer know who W.C. Fields is, or, you know, or they've never seen a Chaplin film. And the reason is because, you know, they have a prejudice against black and white. They've been raised in an era that has almost fostered that. And it's hard to get them to sort of go back. And the comedy is different. It's slower. It's more deliberately paced than what they've been used to. And there's a tendency not to go. You can say I'm a comedy fan and not know who the Marx Brothers are. That would have been unthinkable. That would have been unheard of in the 60s and 70s. If you had said you were a comedy fan and then announced you didn't know who the Marx Brothers were,
yeah,
you would have been drummed out of the conversation.
Yeah.
Well, that's in almost every genre that's possible now. But horror still sort of honors its roots. And I think that's a really great thing about horror fans is you can say to them, have you ever seen the 1956 Invasion of the Body Snatchers? You're like, no. Should I say, oh, yeah, go see. And they will go check it out. It's a black and white movie, 1956. It's 65 years old, like me. And they'll come back and say, wow, that was fantastic. What else can you recommend? You know, they'll look at old Silence with Lon Chaney. They'll look at the old Universal horror films. They'll look at the science fiction horror films from the 50s, like Them and The Thing. Yeah. They'll be into Hammer films. You know, you can. There's a way, and indeed in horror there is still that idea of, you know, you show up for the conversation and you say, well, I'm a horror fan, and he's like, well, what's your favorite Bela Lugosi film? who's Bela Lugosi?
Yeah.
You're going to get drummed out of the room.
Yeah.
You're going to like, go find out who this guy, then come back and we'll let you be in on the, we'll let you into the club, you know? And horror has an appreciation of its roots. And I think that's, again, it's, and that's true on the literary side too. You know, it's unthinkable. It's unthinkable that you would say you were into horror fiction and you not understand the impact and influence of people like Lovecraft and Algernon Blackwood and Poe and Mary Shelley. You know, it would be unthinkable that you wouldn't, you know, at least understand that.
Yeah.
So I think that's one of the things that has kept Kolchak going. There is an appreciation within the horror realm, at least, that this is a very important character. It is a very influential character moving forward. And I think that that is probably the answer to your question. Now, the larger question is basically, how much does Kolchak's legend live outside of the horror realm? My suspicion is, and I hate to say it, I mean, you know, this kills me to say this, because I spent a good deal of the 90s trying to, you know, beat the drum for Kolchak. My suspicion is that, you know, anybody who is outside of the horror realm would have a tough time recognizing the name.
Yeah, I think you're probably right on that.
Now, and I have a stalking horse for that, which is, you know, another one of my books is about Columbo.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I think Columbo's fame has not only endured to a much greater level because he's constantly being reintroduced on a lot of platforms.
Yep.
He was an international hit at the time, and he continues to be very, very popular. Columbo has been one of our favorite exports throughout the decades, and he remains iconically popular throughout Europe, the British Isles, Australia, the Asian countries. In an amazing amount of different cultures, Columbo translates very well.
Hmm.
And he remains popular here. He remains an iconic detective character.
Yeah.
You know, and that, you know, a small publisher reprinted my book on Columbo, The Columbo File. I wrote about 10,000 new words for it. But in late 2019, they reprinted The Columbo File as a 30th anniversary edition, 30th anniversary edition of the original book, which really made my bones creak to realize
that. Yes.
Long ago. The book immediately shot. It was number one the next day after it was published. It was number one in Amazon on books on movies and television.
Yeah.
And it has been selling briskly ever since. I've been just stunned by the response to that. But it speaks to the fact that, you know, Columbo's appeal goes beyond the mystery fans.
Yes.
If it were just mystery fans, the sale on that book would probably have been a lot more modest. But the fact that Columbo is an adored character and an iconic character, again, not just in the United States, but around the world.
Yep.
He's been adopted all the way around. And I would venture to guess that if you'd put this to the test, you know, Charles, if you did a survey in your country and showed, you know, did a bit of a walking tour in cities and small towns, and you took with you a picture of Columbo and a picture of Kolchak, and you showed it to the average person.
Yeah.
Most people would still recognize Columbo, and most people would not recognize Kolchak.
Yeah, I'm afraid you're right on that. Yeah.
And like I said, I think Columbo just continues to, there's a renewable energy source there with Columbo. And the Twilight Zone, it just defies everything by continuing to jump generation to generation. It's amazing that it does. I mean, it's a black and white show that started in 1959. It's staggering that, you know, my students do know. They not only know the Twilight Zone, the name, they know the theme, they know, oh, the gremlin on the wing, the broken glasses, they know, you know, episodes.
Yeah.
So, you know, they know it because, and the Twilight Zone has remained cool. It's cool to like the Twilight Zone. It's cool to know what it is. And, you know, we have watched, you know, I can't speak for the United Kingdom, and nor would I. nobody would want me to. But speaking for the United States, here what we've seen is we have seen shows that used to jump generation to generation fade and fade until they're gone in the pop culture. There were a lot of shows which got reintroduced generation to generation. They would pass it along. That's true of movies too, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, in our certainly like The Honeymooners, the Andy Griffith Show, these were all shows which, you know, we all kind of grew up with. And, you know, The Andy Griffith Show, we all lived in Mayberry for a while. We were all residents of Mayberry. And around 2009, I started to realize that fewer and fewer of my students knew what The Andy Griffith Show was. Until now, it's down to maybe one who watches it with a grandparent or something like that. And that's the fate of most TV shows, black and white, and now even color, where we see the culture moving so fast that very few things actually continue to jump. Mm. That's true in music. That's true in everything. But The Twilight Zone, there's only two black and white TV shows, American TV shows, which continue to defy it. And you can always see it in merchandising. If there's merchandising for it, it means they're using it to sell, which means it's still there in some vital form. And the two that continue to jump are I Love Lucy and The Twilight Zone. They continue to be iconic. They continue to defy the odds. And, while everything else has faded away, while all the other contemporary shows of those time periods have faded away, those two stay there. And that's pretty amazing. Cause like I say, considering they are, you know, 70 years and older, and they're black and white, and they come from a very, very different time.
Yeah.
But again, it's true on the film side. You know, you can say you're into film and not know who Humphrey Bogart is, or not know who John Ford is. You know, I'm a film. You could be a film major and not know who they are, or never seen one of their movies. My students certainly don't know Bogart anymore. Bogart was a rite of passage for us when we were, you know, like the Marx Brothers. They were this kind of thing that you had to discover at a certain age, and you went through it, and it helped form your consciousness. And I talk about the Marx Brothers to myself. I might as well be talking about leaders of the Russian Revolution. They don't know. This was, you know, was Carlo one of the Marx Brothers? So you don't have, you don't see this in comedy. You don't see this in movies. You don't see this, you know, my students sort of iconically know who Charlie Chaplin and Marilyn Monroe are, but they've never seen what film.
Yeah.
They've never seen The Gold Rush. They've never seen City Lights. They've never seen The 7-Year Itch or Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. And they kind of still know who Marilyn is because she is used to sell things.
Yeah.
But they don't really know who she is because they've never really experienced Marilyn, or they've never experienced Chaplin in a true way. And that's, you know, this can very, very quickly start to sound like the oldest old fart ranting against the universe and shaking his fist. And I want to sort of disabuse your listeners of this. It's not. I believe you live in your times. And I also believe that, you know, for every advance that we have, you win something and you lose something. You give something up and you gain something. And I think that that's true of every part of the culture. And if you look for the good things, you'll find them. And certainly if you look for the things you've lost, you'll find them. But that's just what living and to any kind of age is all about. And so you can acknowledge these losses without lamenting and dwelling on them. So when I observe these things, people sound like I'm ranting against them, and I'm not at all. It is what it is. And by the way, there are still a few things which continue to jump generation to generation. You see it in music, the Beatles.
Yeah.
You know, everybody gets exposed to the Beatles still and know who they are. Now, it doesn't mean you'll turn into a Beatles fan, but it means you're still going to be exposed to the music. You're still going to understand why this group was important, and you're going to get a chance to understand what that was all about. On the movie side, there are still movies that continue to jump generation to generation. The Wizard of Oz. Mm-hmm. You know, people have not stopped going down the yellow brick road and sharing that movie with their children. And you can use references from that movie. We're off to see the wizard, you know, follow the yellow brick road, and people will know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
It's a given that they know that those E.T.
Yeah.
E.T. is a more, you know, it's not a modern movie now, but it's certainly a movie that continues to jump generation to generation. Star Wars. You know, Star Wars, may the Force be with you. How, you know, so we still do have things on all fronts that continue to jump. And so we have a little bit of a shared language, not as much as we used to have, and a shared culture and a shared, sadly, not as much as we used to have, you know. But there's still enough to sort of hang our hats on, if you will.
Talking about jumping generations, we're jumping our time zone here, so... It's been a total delight, and thank you ever so much for your time, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Okay, thank you. Enjoyed it.
Once again, a big thank you to this week's guest, Mark Dowidziak. You can find out everything you want to know about his books and work on his website, which is www.markdowidziak.com. That's DAWIDZIAK. But, as ever, we'll have all the links on the Urban Fantasist website and in the podcast metadata. Now it just remains for me to say this is Charles Christian saying thank you so much for listening in. Please join me again next week for more strange tales for strange times. Until then, stay well, stay weird. Goodbye.
Black Shuck, the demon dog of East Anglia, is baying at the moon. Which means it's time for us to go. You've been listening to the Weird Tales radio show with Charles Christian, your weekly fix of ghost stories, urban myths, witchcraft, folklore, and the paranormal. You can keep in touch with us online at www.urbanfantasist.com, by email to urbanfantasist@icloud.com, and on Twitter at @urbanfantasist. Join us again next week for another edition of the Weird Tales radio show. Goodbye.